This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
I'm Q Ling, Carolyn Valverde, and I'm Associate Professor of Asian American Studies and the Founding Director of the New Vietnam Initiative at UC Davis.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all of.
Thanks for coming on today. And we will get to this idea of New Vietnam Studies because that is a big question for me. But before we get into all that, can you tell me a little bit about how you got into academia?
Oh, I think I'm the, I say that I'm the accidental academic because I think I really struggled in school, actually. And I didn't see myself as a teacher, a professor, but in retrospect, I think that's what I was really destined to do. And so I think what happened was, in typical fashion of, immigrant, refugee, Vietnamese American, my family wanted me to be a doctor, lawyer, engineer, that kind of thing. And I think they thought I was going to be maybe a lawyer and they were like, okay, fine. But once I got onto campus, I was really bitten by the bug of ethnic studies and really, seeing that, wow, there's so much to learn and write about my own community. And I really think it started even in high school when I did projects and all I wanted to do was interview people and ask them about their experience. And even answer questions I had, which is why were some of my smartest friends in this thing called New Wave Gangs, and those little things, and then why are the Amerasians treated differently and why do they think I'm Amerasian and, that kind of stuff. So a lot of questions around that or why do they call me, kind of like she's the American one, and then in the context of Vietnam, like, Mutt Gop or something like that, why were I, was I given these names? And so just more curious than anything. And with that curiosity, I think led me to, again, ethnic studies programs where there were, a lot of history around Asian Americans, but how they looked at our community was very strange. It was so new still, I'm a pre-75er. So, some of the first groups to go to university as young people, like the 1.5 gen. And so I was kind of shocked by the ways in which they were talking about the community, politically speaking. And then when I got into deeper, I realized, wow, our community has a very specific political point of view and is not shared by, the mainstream Americans or mainstream Americans or, and then I'm like, wow, there's just so many different diverse points of view. And that I was really interested in writing that history, writing that experience. I think all of us as young people, living whatever we're living, we're interested in writing about that. And then it just always takes like a decade or two before the book comes out. And then by then it's like ancient history,
Speaking of ancient history, do you ever feel like writers and identity sort of chasers like us that you read about, authors that you read about, eventually in their 60s or 70s or something, do they settle in into who they are? Or do you think it's a lifelong chasing ordeal for us?
Whoa. I think that's a good question. I think personally speaking, it would be a life long journey to figure out who the heck I am. But as a scholar and one that, tries to facilitate stories, I'm always on a mission of getting people to tell their stories
Yeah.
or getting young people to tell their stories unapologetically and not feel they have to hold on to a story that they feel is more compelling or more traumatic, that, you know, whatever story they have to talk about, like, you know, they can. And I mean, that's what I do in my first class, first day of class in my Southeast Asian American courses. I say, hey, you never asked for my permission, but you have my permission to write your story. You don't have to write my generation story or the one previous. That is just as valid as anything else to write your story. And most of them just like start crying or sigh of relief, that because they really thought they needed to carry on a certain narrative, you know? And so I guess to answer your question, I think first and foremost, people need to feel like they can tell their story without kind of censorship or self-censorship or this like, oh, kind of honoring, you know, past histories. And then for me personally, I'm still chasing what it is to be Vietnamese, Vietnamese American, Vietnamese in diaspora, VietQ, you know, mixed race, you know, I'm like women, you know? Yeah.
How old were you when you came to the United States?
I was around 3.
And you are you come from a mixed heritage background?
Yeah, so both my parents are mixed race from the European period, the French period, and so and I know this because they told me, but also because DNA shows that I'm like this weird mixture of about 70% Vietnamese, and then the rest is European.
So did they grow up in Vietnam with mixed heritage parents? I mean, can you tell me about that?
So man, this is a long story and it's like a weird one. But on my mom's side, oh God, yeah.
Stories, yeah.
Like buckle in. No. So on my mom's side, the funny thing is people always say, man, she's only a quarter. How come she looks so not Vietnamese, right? But my mom is Eurasian. Her father is Spanish, but grew up and lived in France. So he was part of the, you know, the missionaries. The soldiers that were coming to Vietnam during the French period. And so I'm Spanish. I'm probably Basque, you know, background, but in long time, multi-generation living in Provence in France. So that's my father's background. And he was, my grandfather. And so my mom is half, like straight up half from the European, you know, era. Then my grandmother is mixed race on my Banoi. And so she is, so my paternal grandmother is mixed race. You know, she says she's a quarter. That could make sense. She could also be half, more likely. But my father and my aunts and uncles on my paternal side look mixed, and their children look like me. But they're the pure Vietnamese, right? So it just came out one day. I think my grandmother was in her 80s, and we were in, you know, bed with my sister, and she says, I have a confession, you know, I have a confession. And she's like, I mix. And she went into this, oh my God, dramatic, long epic story of her mixedness and her family background. And, you know, it was phenomenal. And my sister, who's like worse in Vietnamese than I am, looked over to me and she said, did I understand right? And then we kind of laughed about it because we always knew that anyway. We kind of joke that, you know, someone in the family ran too slow in the village, you know, and then that kind of joke. But in reality, she kept a secret.
Why was it such a big deal for her?
Yeah, it's hard to say because, you know, she came from a family of bankers and married a governor and so on. Oh, I know what it was. Her mother, and this is very typical, her mother was married to her father, who, and he was, you know, banker and mixed race and had another life and had another family. And so she was devastated. So she ran back to her village, and in her village, she remarried. married and all that. And so she took my grandmother, like, you know, just took her away. And it wasn't until they moved back to Hanoi that the family was like, we've been looking for you, you know, since you were taken away. And this is your family. And so my grandmother had secretly kept in touch with her father's side of the family until her mother found out. And so it was always, you know, she was also always made pretty clear that if you talk about that side of the family and mix is just a part of that factor, then you are, you know, going against your stepfather who raised you, going against my wishes because I was, you know, this woman that was done wrong. And so I think in the back of her mind, she couldn't talk about that side of the family. Yeah, that's part of it.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tung Fak.
I, you know, and probably being mixed didn't help.
Yeah. And all of these things, it's, you know, when we're growing up, we don't realize how much of an impact all this information and data points affect us. And as we're going through, right? And as we're going through life and studying and reading and talking to people, these things come up.
They do. Yeah. And I feel like another factor that runs through our community is this idea of secrets and piecing together the puzzle of our history, as fragmented as it is. Just and you know, we're of a generation like we don't make judgments on what happened in the past, but they make judgments because of the societal norms in which they were growing up. But we just want to know our history, right? We just want to know our background and without judgment. And yeah.
And I think that we're able to do that because of the normalization of just mistakes, accidents, humanity being humans. And I think we've removed the barriers of religion for the most part. We've removed a lot of cultural judgments that, you know, so we're able to kind of live as our own anthropologists looking, peering backwards without any judgment. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you?
I, you know, honestly, maybe it's cliche in some ways, but it's just this feeling I have when I'm back in Vietnam is a feeling I have when I hear Vietnamese spoken. It's a feeling I have when I, you know, drawn to Vietnamese food in the way that I am. And it is this idea too that, you know, I've been told that I could maybe pass or, you know, reject my community or what have you. And my thought was, why would I? Like, you know, so it's just always been ingrained in me by birth and by choice that I am Vietnamese. Yeah. There's a running joke too that I call myself mojam nuk mam, you know, because that's 100% something, right? Because people always want to say, oh, you're not 100% something, you know, and I feel I am 100% Nuk Mam.
When you go back, when we go back into this academic path and you say you weren't a good student, well, what led you down to becoming somebody in academia? I mean, it's a hard path to get that degree, and then it's a hard path to go and teach and deal with the politics and all of it. What was the deciding factors of you going in that direction?
I think maybe two. One is really basic, which is I think I'm really good at it. And so I just, you know, I'm not good at like the mechanics of it, I'll be honest, but I'm really good at theorizing and thinking and looking at patterns. Like I think I just naturally am that, you know, social scientist, anthropologist, like that's just my nature. I'm good at that. I think the other reason, once I got into a position at a university and a tenured position, I was always, you know, in the beginning, I was like, oh, I better keep this job because I really want to model and I really want to create, you know, a pathway for my young Vietnamese students and Southeast Asian students, Asian students, whomever, to pursue academia, because I knew that there weren't a lot lot of people in my position to do that. And so I kept on like, no matter what, I was like, just keep this job so you can help the next generation, you know? And then in position I am now, it's like, okay, same, you know, just continue to do a good job so that you can make sure that, you know, students see you up there talking about these, you know, radical ideas that they will be moved to explore and ask questions and get to answers and have legitimate networks that they can count on. Like they can count on me to make sure that they get to the next level of where they need to go if that is their passion, you know? So that's a big part of it, really, honestly, just to make sure that my students get some way, because I was lucky enough to have mentors that saw something in me and made sure that I got to where I needed to go. Yeah.
I asked that question because, like you, I didn't grow up motivated to go to school. I didn't even know I was going to go to college. I just happened to do it, you know, after the military. But here's where this question is going to get a little sticky and weird.
Go for it.
I just attended an academic conference by Dr. Thung Vu in Oregon. And
I know him.
Yeah, all these academics got together. And it was really a mystery to me how some of these academics came from bigger institutions, and then some came from smaller state institutions like San Francisco State or Notre Dame or, you know, bigger universities back east. And what drives my questions all the time, especially when I talk to somebody like you, is it's so damn hard to get a professor gig, right? And it's so difficult to land in these different pockets. But some of the conversations I had with these academics were like, they were recruited to go to these big universities. And then some at the state level were fighting tooth and nail to get this position. I'm confused. What does it take to get hired in academia? What separates the people who are like being recruited at Columbia, Cornell, to go to those institutions to teach versus the ones that are like at Cal State LA, San Francisco State, and really trying to fight for their tenure or trying to get a position? You're at UC Davis. What does it all mean?
I think there were different camps, you know, even when I was going to school, and I still feel that they remain the same. There are those who are just like tracked towards like the Ivy Leagues. They're of a certain, I guess, social station. And so there's that idea of there's already a network in place, and then they get recruited because of the schools that they come from, like even prestigious high schools or whatever. And then so there's this kind of track, or they come from really, you know, well-informed private schools where that is their track. And so there is already in place where they need to go. Then there's the rest of us, honestly, that that didn't have that. And we're not even smart about it because, for example, in retrospect, if I had just told my story in my high school application and applied for a Yale or a Harvard, I would have gotten in.
Wow.
But it's because we grew up in an ethnic community where everyone experienced that. And so we don't even think to make that as a story, or that we think, oh no, but that's something we got over. Like, you know, we went beyond that refugee experience, and now we don't want to talk about that because we're like just like you. That's a huge mistake, because most people don't have a refugee experience. Most people didn't have to go, you know, live in sort of poverty or be displaced or have to learn about language or have to negotiate, you know, language for their parents and or come from, you know, sort of very poorly resourced schools in urban squalor, you know, like that's not the norm, you know, but it's a norm for us. So then we don't even think to do that. So then I would say that, you know, if you are on that path, if you are of a certain, you know, socioeconomic, you know, station, then, and that includes like writers, you know, why do writers get book contracts and others don't, you know, it's because you are in a circle where you're having dinners with publishers, or you're having dinners with parents of publishers, you know, And so then you just happen to pitch, oh, I just want to write a random story. And they're like, well, why don't you send us something? Well, there are those who are writing every day, have amazing stories, and they don't know how to get their work published because they're not a part of this sort of network. So I would say that's one part of it. In terms of how I got there, I think because I had no sense of how to play the game, so I did this like other weird thing. And for my school at that time, that weird thing was what they wanted. That was like, for example, I mentioned that when I was in school, I was even told by top scholars to do refugee studies or to do, look at the community, the way it is and their, assimilation process. And I was already traveling to Vietnam since 93. And I could have even gone there earlier, actually, for various projects. And so what I observed was something very different. I observed transnational linkages. And I observed very early on that they were saying, hey, this whole cottage industry or this whole set of funding is coming from the overseas population. They're sustaining Vietnam, which was made up a political economic pariah by the US. So they were, they had an embargo on them. So they were not doing well. So how did they sustain themselves? Frankly, it was through the overseas remittances, for example, right? So I was learning about that, and I was learning about, oh, Paris by Night videos getting, bootlegged into the country, and people were watching that and mimicking some of those things and so on and so forth. And so I was like, whoa, there are these, transnational connections. And I went against area studies, which was like very much looking at sexual practices or village life or whatever. And I was going against Asian American studies at the time, which was very nation bound. Like, what are we as Asian Americans? What is our piece of the American pie? And I went, like, I bucked those two schools to meld them into this work on transnationalism. So when I went for my job, I was just this crazy outlier that was talking about this newfangled thing called transnationalism. And they're like, that's hot. We want to hire, and that's how I got hired. Or I could have easily, been a part of a department at the time that would have said, well, this doesn't sound like what we know about Vietnamese American. We don't feel comfortable with this. So let's not hire her. We're going to keep with our old stories, what we know, that doesn't involve bilingualism or biculturalism or whatever, And so, yeah, no, I mean, I would say, luck. The other thing too, and maybe some talent, but the other thing too is what was happening in universities then and now is their departments are very small. Ethnic studies are very small. So they usually have like one like Vietnamese, one Chinese, one Japanese, and they kind of clustered under that. And so when I was going into the market, there were quite a few windows open for a like quote unquote Southeast Asian hire. And so I think I was able to get into one of those windows. And it's fortunate if you open up and have more hires in these ethnic categories. But otherwise, someone has that job and they're there for 20 plus years, and then people are very talented scholars are out and about, working as lecturers or adjuncts and not able to get into the position. They're no more or less talented than I am or well trained than I am. I will say that. But it is that ethnic studies is grassroots. It's from students. It's from the community. It's never been fully supported by the top down, which is like more area studies. Like they want area studies in order to understand our enemy, that kind of thing, funded by the government and military industrial complex, whatever. But we are from the ground. And so we're always by threat of being pushed out. And then, in my case, you have a lot of now Asian American studies professional, Asian American studies types that fall into that, mentality of what academy is, and they don't remember the history and its inception of, ethnic studies. So they even turn on their own, by saying, well, you're doing too much community work, or you're helping students too much, or you should just be like, cranking out books, And in my university, we're a research one university where you're basically rewarded for, cranking out books, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The idea of New Vietnam and New Vietnam studies, what does that even mean? There's so much shade and gray area when I think of the word New Vietnam. What
Yeah.
do you find in that definition, New Vietnam
Yeah.
studies?
So the situation is this. Maybe I should talk about the origin of why I even thought to do this. There was a exhibit going on in I believe it was 35 years around there, going in Oakland, California. So they had a an exhibit on the Vietnam War, and the curator was just fascinated with these kind of like typical tropes of photography, at the time. And so they had this exhibit. It was going on during the time of the Iraqi War too. And so I had a good friend. I won't mention her name, or maybe I will. But anyway, she was working as a hire because they got a grant to do community outreach and history as part of this, right? And she brought in a bunch of Vietnamese American history, and they were ignoring her. So she called me up, and she said, "Hey, Killing, they're going against the grant. They're ignoring my work on the Vietnamese American. In general, they're ignoring the Southeast Asian American history as part of this Vietnam war and California history. And I'm wondering, should I call them out on it?" And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely, do it. Go for it," right? And she did, and she got, unceremoniously fired, right? And so I just felt like shit, obviously. And then so she, but the Cambodian community rallied for her, right? And what happened? And then, and then the Vietnamese were like, "Oh, we better do something about it." So the Vietnamese American community probably felt a little guilty for not supporting her earlier, came on to support her. And then so there was an ad hoc group that was created with scholars and community leaders, and I was a part of that. And because of that, I got carte blanche into the origins of the museum, and I got carte blanche into its development and even feedback when it got started. And what I noticed was that everyone felt so strongly about the Vietnam War era, and they all felt it was their history, it was their Vietnam, it was their experience. So the Chicanos, who had the largest protests in the history of Chicano movement, for the moratorium, that is, they were disproportionately drafted for the war, felt this was a lasting legacy. You had folks of color that were talking about how it was this revolution in Vietnam that brought about revolution everywhere else. There were nurses talking about experiences, soldiers, and African Americans that were very much feeling like they too were a part of a revolution, as an oppressed group in the United States, right? And they were very much for the other side, for the North side, actually, because they're like, "Oh, the US oppresses us here, and now they're going to other parts in the imperialist project," and so on and so forth. And I just had an epiphany that I'm like, "Oh my God, here I am as a Vietnamese American trying to express that this is my Vietnam." I realized that Vietnam is not owned by me, is not owned by my community, it's owned by the world, in fact, that you cannot talk about, anti-colonial movements without looking at the playbook of Vietnam. You can't talk about revolution, you can't talk about anything. And to this day, like, even the leaders in Palestine, for example, Arafat got training, support, and advisement from the Vietnamese in order to deal with what was going on, in Palestine against the Israelis, and things like that, that those kind of hidden stories made me go, "Wow. And I'm here trying to give voice to this community." And what I realized at that point is, wow, Vietnam is like more than that, and then the other part of it was, but in the West and in the United States in particular, the vast majority of what's written about Vietnam is the war. And here I was, going back and forth to Vietnam and living there for years for my research, and seeing the transnational dynamic linkages, I was like, no, Vietnam is well beyond the war. And in fact, the Vietnam War was a drop in the bucket of 3,000 years of, different kind of struggles that that Vietnamese have, those who were those, countries are encroaching on them, but also them encroaching on other countries. Let's be real. Vietnam also had imperialist aims, And so it was all that made me think, Well, history is important. History is, teaches us lessons. History shows us patterns, and all that's important. But where Vietnam is now, and that was like at that time when I was starting up this, my center was like about 40 years out, right? And now it's almost 50 years out. Vietnam is very different. And for most of us who have kind of any kind of connection to that country would know this or have research on the community here and its effects on and effects of the country will also understand that. But most people don't. So I was very much like, okay, we need and there's so many scholars out there doing this kind of work. We need a center to really help facilitate these kind of conversations, right? Let the people know wherever they are in the world that there is this new Vietnam, right? New being and so new is like where it is now and moving towards the future. And maybe old would be the old narratives of Vietnam as a limiting connected to it only a period in time, a small period in time that we call Vietnam War era.
Got it. Got it. And so it just sounds like a very broad definition of anything after 75.
Really, we just focus on whatever issues are affecting the youth now. And the youth, I kind of like 40 and under. I know that's a very old youth, but it's a younger population of what is important to this group, And then we have programming and research and whatever else to really address that, like for example, looking at say, Silicon Valley, how who were the Vietnamese that were involved in the making. The beginnings of the Silicon Valley, and then how are those, and how I mean, it's really intricate. A lot of my work goes deep into like, how did internet get started in Vietnam? Well, it started out with, connections with those in Australia and United States in the Silicon Valley that helped individuals in Vietnam get trained in what was happening in terms of internet and going to places like UC Berkeley and then going back to Vietnam and starting up internet there. Like people don't know this history, this very transnational, deep under the radar of, say, anti-communist protesters, etc., history that has now made where Vietnam is and now it has like campuses of internet and so on and so forth. So that was one of our international symposiums or and looking at ways in which where investments goes and things like that. Or even looking at a topic that is entrenched in Vietnam War era like Agent Orange, but showing that there's a documentary that is nominated for Academy that is looking at the efficacy and the agency of those who are truly afflicted from Agent Orange, looking at the cleanup, looking at the societal issues that families face that have long-standing issues with those who've been afflicted with Agent Orange. So it's in our lands, it's in our ecosystem, right? And you're probably aware of that, where the birds and the fish and where we grow, it's all there. And scientists say there's no end to that. We don't know when it can really truly be out of our lands. So what that means is it's part of our DNA, that women fear taking ultrasounds because they do not want a child who has, Agent Orange, symptoms, right? And I go to the hospitals and I see children being born on a daily basis with severe deformities due to Agent Orange. So, we look at it from the film, are part of it, from the scientific part of it, from the social part of it, and who are still looking at these issues and bring it to the forefront. So we take a look at various things, and I think one of the most important ones we looked at recently was on South China Sea, and that's where they were building. Basically Cold War on sea, where they had the Russians and the British and the Americans and the Chinese in particular, all kind of converging into South China Sea, which has the world's second largest oil reserves offshore, the most trafficked trade route, and most fishery. And so it is the reason why Vietnam historically, since ancient time, has been important and was important for Americans and others during the war is because of the resources there. Like, that's what it is, you know? And so it continues to be very important. So the Filipinos and the Vietnamese and the Chinese are, you know, kind of, you know, fighting over that area. So we had three, during COVID, we had three workshops that looked, and online, that looked at this issue. And we had thousands and, you know, the 10,000s of viewers across, you know, the seas, because this is really affecting Vietnamese sovereignty, not to mention Filipino, but also, you know, China's, you know, air, land, sea, you know, mandates, trying to take over much of this area, because it is about, for them, control of trade routes, right? Because they want to control that.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese-American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam. When I think about all the conflicts that are happening within our Vietnamese sort of diaspora overseas in Vietnam, or, you know, all the little enclaves that are Vietnamese related, you know, you start to analyze and think about all these things, and sometimes they're not even related. It's weird. And what I mean by that is this, like this whole idea of reconciliation, right? You know, that was brought up in this year. I went to a few events and, you know, the word was brought up. And in some cases, the Vietnamese government and the Canadian government have been working with each other, alongside each other, since the 90s to bring capitalism into their economy. Or you start to, you know, research Fulbright University in Vietnam right now, and they're thinking what the Vietnamese government is about academic freedom. But on the flip side, you have like all of these people who are waving, you know, their three-stripe flag here in the United States. And it's like ships in the night, missing each other. Everything's like all over the place with just weird paths to me. They're just strange. Some are in direct conflict and some are not. Some are kind of fantastic, fantasy like in their mind when you think about the older generation.
I will say there's two thoughts on this, okay?
Yeah.
They're very different. One would say, and I won't mince words, the sheer trauma of growing up in a community where there is so much censorship that one dared not to create art, writings, scholarship, you name it, for fear of being called a communist or chuk mũ, you know? And that created a terror. I mean, it was terrorism, where we then self-censored. We dared not say anything. Because your house could be burned down, people can be killed, you can be ostracized from the community. I'm not going to mince any words. It was severe.
And then you think about the relationship of that sort of ethos, right? I mean, that's the exact same thing that we ran from. And it's inside of our DNA to be hate.
You know, I will make an argument. You're going to many places that there's many things I have to say about. So that's one aspect of it, right? So let's go down that, and then I can go to the other part of it. So you're saying, yes, that what I'm describing sounds like communism. and I've had that happen. You know, I was a joiner scholar, a Luce Foundation scholar in Boston. And I was... I decided to interview one of the protesters because they're like, oh, you know, they've given scholarship to those from Vietnam. And so that there's communists. And then they've given it to this person. At the time, I was young. So they're like, to this kid, what does she know about history, you know? And then so I interviewed one of the protesters, and he was, you know, an academic of sorts, and but he was in prison, and he came out, and when I came to him, he said, I know you, I know your history. And he started to list off all, you know, my biography, and it was bogus. Okay. And then I just had like, oh my God, that triggered when I was in Vietnam and they rounded up my friends and who spoke to me. And I thought I was in the clear, but I was in researching in Hanoi, and they rounded up people that I came across with and started saying, we know her, this is her history. And it was a bogus history. And so literally I had very similar experiences in both the United States from one camp and in Vietnam by like the police, Coman or whomever, you know? And so, yeah, the irony is not lost on me. So I will say that is one aspect of it. And we're very in a very different place now, thank God. But that it took me 20 years to write my book. And when it came out, there were still these like raging, you know, fiery thoughts on that issue is a testament to how much we didn't change, right? Now, on the other side, what you talk about in terms of like ships moving in the night and they seem so unrelated, I can make relations, but I think what's more important to think about it and how I think about it is those are histories. And it's legitimate. You have the history of a person who is wholeheartedly hanging on to a 20-year period of what's called South Vietnam, right? It was only 20 years, by the way. Yeah. But those 20 years is a generation, right? And so for that generation, that is their nation. That is their, you know, what they know, and that's what they'll hold on to. And so for everyone else, they grew up in the U.S. or Vietnam was unified, life most goes on. But for that group, it was very, very important to hold on to that history. And they fear, rightfully so, that it could be miswritten in the way they wouldn't approve of, or it would be forgotten. So people hang on to that history. Then simultaneously, there's real life situations that's happening every day. Trade is going on. There's massive amounts of overseas Vietnamese coming back to Vietnam, investing, vacationing, visiting family, marrying, so on and so forth, right? So all that is going on simultaneously. And so they seem like they're not connected, but they're connected. I mean, I remember one time there was a protest in Southern California. It was FOB 2. And there was a gentleman in fatigue protesting about this exhibit that really was looking to bring artists together from Vietnam and the U.S. to talk about this, like 40 years of Vietnam or something like that. And one of the gentlemen had just gone to Vietnam and married a Vietnamese person, you know, ostensibly a communist, right? And brought her back to the U.S. And that's okay, right? But not, you know, young people having an exhibit on art about their experience as Vietnamese people. So the irony is not lost on anybody. And it happens simultaneously. And people sort of rationalize that one is okay and one is not okay, depending on, you know, how they want to do things. But the reality of it is, you know, our histories are linked and intertwined. And I mean, you know, my book has a communist flag and has a Vietnamese, you know, former South Vietnam flag, and then an American flag in there, I believe. And when it was brought up in Vietnam, I was almost deported, you know, because these flags don't necessarily belong together in the mindset of those here and those there, right? But they do come together at points in protests. The picture was of a protest of the protest at the FOB 2 event, you know. So anyway. I don't really get upset about it anymore. I don't think it's as bad as it used to be. I'm always on the fringes anyway. So I think that's how I just managed to maneuver. And I would have never done a podcast like this back in the day because ironically, you know, when you're a scholar, you want to get your work out. I mean, like maybe five people read your book, right? So you want to get your work out as much as possible. But ironically, I couldn't, not initially, not for the initial 20 years of my research, because it could cost me my connection to my community here in the United States, and it could cost me access to information in Vietnam. So I could not give interviews. I could not talk about my research. I just had to really protect my informants. And I actually had to build 20-year relationship with my informants in order to get the information I needed. But once the book was out, then I owned it, you know, then I was like, okay, it's fine. Yeah.
You know, we can continue down this path for a long, many, many hours, but I do want to get into this soul spiritual experience.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I do. Because what you talked about, we can continue talking about for hours, like I said, but yeah, we are limited on time. And I want to talk to you about your experience in the spirit realm, because I think as an academic, I would like to hear you break down your experience in the spirit realm, and I want to hear your thoughts on it, because I don't really believe in any of that yet.
I was raised a Catholic too, and I am aware that you were raised a Catholic.
Yeah.
And so that has a lot to do with this idea of not connecting to what I think is pretty commonplace. So my experience is of a young person growing up in Vietnam and in the United States, being really afraid of ghosts or ma, right? But that's because Vietnamese people are animists. And so we believe in our like spirit of ancestors. Catholic or not, you will have images of your, you know, family, deceased family on your altar. I mean, that is the syncretic kind of hybrid versions of our belief system. That so part of it is really animus, spirit. We believe that spirits can hang around, can linger. We maybe, you know, whatever. And then so we sort of maybe suppress a lot of that, especially in the context of the United States, compounded with maybe our religious beliefs that are, we're told there's not that, and then, you know, life is final and you go to heaven and that kind of thing, or hell. And so I just put it in the background for the longest time. And it wasn't until I had my near-death experience where I guess I went to the other side. And so those a lot with the, you know, NDEs will tell you the same thing, which is, you know, if they don't experience a certain understanding where they are, they definitely come with it when they leave. So with me is I had a harrowing journey in afterlife, and then I fought for what I thought to be 600 years or something like that to come back into this plane. And then as an academic, I was confused, you know. I was like, what was that, you know? And then but when I reached the recesses of my mind, I remembered that I had already known this was going to happen. And so then I started trying to research on what that was. And that's when I, you know, went down, you know, looking at, you know, quantum physics and looking at, you know, other explanations to try to understand what happened. And I started teaching courses, scientifically speaking, on the spirit realm. And most of my students were pre-med students that were trying to understand, you know, some of their communities and all that too. And then I realized, you know, and that was 10 years ago. So then now it's all caught up, this idea of indigenous wisdom, this idea of our culture, and this idea of healing properties and powers. It's not necessarily in a bottle, you know, from big pharma. It could be through these other ways, through, you know, herbal medicine, or through shamanism, or through anything else that has been effective for thousands of years, you know, essentially making them scientific. Because if it's been effective over and over and over again, that's why people do it. There's a science to it. Maybe it's not a science that this, you know, this newly fangled Western medicine can explain, but those who have been practicing for, you know, eons across cultures can understand it. And I want to go back to the Catholicism thing, because When I started to look at shamanism, and I myself have sight around these issues, and growing up Catholic, it always crosses, like, my shaman work and understanding always crosses back to even Catholicism. And so one of the things I realize is that actually in a lot of these religions, they're very similar. They come from very similar sources and very similar understanding, and it's written somewhere in this way. Like, for example, in shamanism, how you become a shaman is often through a very traumatic experience. You often get very sick. It's sometimes even near-death experience, or you've been, brutalized in horrible ways, and then you're like, hanging by a thread, and then you come back and have these powers, and their powers often to heal, and you can heal your village, or you can heal people, so on and so forth. And so that's in shamanism. Where in Catholicism is very similar. We hear these stories, and so the Vatican starts investigating, and they investigate those who have these, miraculous, abilities, and they make them into saints, right? So very similar. Or in like, shamanistic work, for example, you might say, okay, I'm feeling out of sorts. I'm not myself. And they might, in the West, they'll take you to a psychiatrist or a therapist, and then they, give you, institutionalize you or give you medicine, whatever. But in a place like Vietnam, they'll say, like, go to a shaman, and they'll exorcise you, right? From because there was a demon in you or those kind of things. And so they explain it that way, and you could be like cured of this, right? And so in Catholicism, it's the same thing. You have someone that's behaving wrong or what have you, they send somebody from, the church to come and exorcise you. But somehow that's okay. And shamanism, and these indigenous beliefs is weird, backwards, primitive. And you know what I mean? So my work really is about finding points where they're very similar. They're saying the same stories. They're talking about ultimately, if we look at, say, Jesus Christ and Buddha and others, their message is love. Their message is to, be kind, to be, forgiving and gracious, and to know that the great power from a God is love. And so those who are practicing in the most devout ways are one that preach kindness, that preach about giving, that preach about understanding, and so on and so forth. And those messages are across, many, many different belief systems, and so it's this idea of we're always looking to find differentness, and my work is always looking to find sameness, and that's true even my work with the university, and how it's a very divide and conquer tactic, in getting ethnic groups against ethnic groups, and then the ultimate culprit is this white male figure, And my argument all along is it's engineered, the differences. It's engineered who's on the top and who's on the bottom. And so when we understand that it is socially engineered in order to extract resources from us and keep us in, a state of, in a sense, indentured, servitude to our jobs, to our debt, to our, what we perceive as success and not success. If they can keep those things going, then and say that it's the other person's fault because of XYZ, then we're fighting amongst ourselves. Versus, those who actually have power, which is not the point, which is not the 3% or 0.01%, but the 0.00001%, that really set up a system that just serves to divide us and doesn't allow us to really understand who we are, where we come from, and the powers that we have within us.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about that near-death experience? And you said you went to the other side.
I mean, it was, I was fighting for tenure at my university, and under a lot of stress, lack of sleep. I was pregnant at the time, and I lost my child at home at 6 months, and I was brought to the hospital, and then I went into cardiac arrest and my blood and pronounced dead. No oxygen to my brain for 90 minutes as they tried to resuscitate me. They kept me on every life support system you could imagine, with emergency surgeries to boot. And, they said even if I recover, I would be, you know, at best, you know, 60%. They thought I was going to be institutionalized for the rest of my life. And then I miraculously came back. and everyone just looked at each other like, what? And then they wrote articles about this miraculous coming back and how that could have even happened. And yeah, that's the sort of the technical part of it that I learned later, because for me, it was all very spiritual. I was just on the other side fighting demons and looking at the futures and seeing how I could, you know, come back in my space and in my body, really. You know, I think I could have come back in any form, you know, a spirit, another body, whatever. But I was really intent on coming back to my body because I had young children, a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old at the time. So it was really important that I was back to guide them, you know, in this form. And so, yeah, that was my experience. And then subsequently, I just, I'm in ceremony where I am able to gather information from different realms, if you will. Okay.
So when I have guests on and they say I am in ceremony, it typically sometimes, not all the time, but refers back to ayahuasca.
No.
Okay. So that's,
I think that's a perfectly good way. And I think any kind of, you know, herbal, you know, medicine that's been, you know, I mean, cause they're, when you work with a shaman, the shaman is trying to find you medicine, and that's perfectly good. In my case, my medicine, if you will, is, music and movement. And so, it just, you know, I just happen to know it's just like having a conversation with someone, you know, and through that, those messages from the other side, I'm able to, you know, understand that music and dance are the portal to the spirit realm. And so, I go in ceremony that way. A ceremony for me is just meditation, just sitting down and closing my eyes.
I talked to, Dr. Thung Vu, and, you know, we had this sort of, I had a question about the French and the missionaries bringing Catholicism in, and we're losing, you know, so much of our practices, perhaps our spiritual practices that yes. We as Vietnamese people had with the animus, with all of these things that we had for probably hundreds of years that we developed as indigenous people of that land. Right. Mm-hmm. And he said it wasn't such a bad thing. He goes, give him a little bit more credit, you know. And I think, you know, he comes from, and my mother really come from this pro-Catholic background. But I come from a different place. I come from a place of believing that all people on earth should be about love. And we should not talk about organized religion if we can't even practice the most important thing, which is loving each other, right? And that's it just goes down to that fundamental belief. And
it's
just so fundamental to me. And you know, all
it is
highfalutin, you know, because I grew up in the Catholic Church, so I can talk about it. You know? It's so ranking, it's so much like order, and it's just so much. But I really, at the end of the day, believe Jesus Christ was all about just giving the other cheek. Once you get hit on one side, you give the other. It's just
the ultimate prophet. Yeah, amazing Jesus Christ. I mean, see, the thing is, I don't believe in, also, once you have this enlightenment that you know that it is about love, that you reject a religion or reject, a prophet. I think I'm about understanding that, you know, those who've been enlightened, have been given message, have been able to connect to the universe in this amazing way and try to tell us, you know, the ways of this. And so they map out, you know, some of the first writings in the Bible, or they map out through, you know, scriptures, or they map out through art. They map out how we can access information. And that's all that is. We just, and the information ultimately is reminding us of who we are. You know, reminding of us who we are, reminding why we're here. When people understand that we choose to be here, we choose to have these lessons, and we will come back to this oneness, then people chill out a little bit more. I think people fear death. People have just too many fears. And people, especially now, there's a lot of talk about trauma and inherent trauma and all that. And you can explain it any which way, and that is fine. But ultimately, I'm much more, and I know this because of my practice, and because of information I've gotten since from very young age, is that, you know, we choose to be here. We choose to have this life. You get to know your present, you know, past, and you get to know all that. And then you choose, Kenneth, you chose to be Kenneth. You chose to be a Vietnamese man who, you know, his family immigrated over here, you know, from a Catholic background, who then decides he's going to do a pot. You chose all that, you know, because you needed to learn what you needed to learn. And this was the best way for you to learn it in this lifetime. And that, to me, is very powerful. So I don't trip. Even when I, have challenges, and I have them all the time, trust me, I at least know my mission in this planet. And I think that's the greatest gift. If you can be in ceremony and ask that question, why am I here? Because that is really all we care about as people. We just like, why are we here? What is the meaning of life, right? Once you have that answer, then everything else just kind of, you know, it's just what it needs to be in order for us to move forward with our mission, you know? I mean, I'm thinking about your work, and I'm like, wow, yeah, he has a great mission, because he's connecting information, he's connecting people. And then if people get access to that, and they need to have access, you need to have a wide, you know, viewership and listeningship to get this, then my God, your impact is phenomenal. What you're doing is phenomenal. And I get it. You know what I mean? Yeah.
I appreciate the kind words. I just am... kind of like in this because I just want to stay open enough to be able to receive information from every corner of the world through the eyes and the prism of Vietnamese heritage or Vietnamese culture, Vietnamese people, and or people who are, you know, allies or supporters, adjacent, you know, all of that. And just through the perspective of the Vietnamese. But I do know that whether I'm Vietnamese or Palestinian, we're living parallel lives all throughout the history of mankind. You know, if you took the Palestinian refugee that's suffering right now, that was, you know, whether that was in the North Vietnam or South Vietnam, we were all struggling and going through pain, you know, 55, 60 years ago, all the way up until, you know, 20, 30 years ago, as Vietnam's history, and it's all like stratas and different points, Afghanistan, Ukraine, all of these sufferings are still continuing to this day. And I just feel like Vietnamese is just one way of kind of expressing these historical markers in our people, but we're living parallel lives with these other refugee communities throughout the world.
But the idea is too that we are evolving. Yes. I mean, it seems like we're not, and it seems like history repeats itself a lot. But at the same time, you know, moments like the pandemic, you know, there are those who got really important lessons through that, that changed their life completely, that would have been stuck and not been able to go through what they need to go through, you know? So even these moments, I think, allows us to find a different way to get to answers.
You're right. I think you're absolutely right. I wanted to do the podcast 10 years ago, but because of the pandemic, it allowed me to buckle in and really, you know, I'm doing this. And you know, the other strange thing is, because I've done the podcast, it's allowed me to do some other things now that I didn't see. It gave me skill sets to do something else that I did not see coming in my life. And I think that life is just a sort of a series of these things. And then you get sort of to a place of clarity, and then you die, you pass on and move to the next stage.
Yeah, and that's okay too. You know, I mean, it's, you know, because death will come and you're dying when you're supposed to die. But in the meantime, you know, if you have something you want to accomplish in that time, then you try to do it. And if you don't get it this time, you'll get it next time. It's fine. It's all, you know, it's all as it should be, you know, it's all as it should be. And I get, you know, and I often ask, hey, shouldn't I be moving along in these ways and that ways? And I always get the answer from spiritus, and this is an important one, you'll get it too, is you're where you need to be when you need to be. This is the right time for all that is to be, you know? So it's not that you needed to do that 10 years ago. 10 years ago was not right. You did the podcast when you needed to do the podcast. And yes, the catalyst was, you know, COVID, and COVID is a catalyst for many things. I mean, on the one hand, you got billionaires making more money and gobbling up whatever they need to gobble up in order to create their universe the way they want to on this planet. But also humans, and I was saying this from the best of my knowledge, humans are kind of base and pretty unevolved in many ways. I mean, we can attest to that. Let's say, you know, wars and atrocities and, you know, just the human condition could be pretty atrocious. But I will say this, my understanding is that humans, at the very least, or at the very most, are entities that make their own choices. They make their own choices. So even as you map out your life and map out your mission, you can make changes. You can change your mind and go on this other path. So in that way, we have a very strange sense of resiliency or living or what it is. And so no matter what, no matter how things are, humans are so capable of fighting to their last breath. That I will give humans. They are fighters.
I agree with that. I agree. Now we're going to make a hard left turn here. We're going to go into the last direction that I wanted to really talk about, because it's probably both of one of our favorite topics, you and I. The topic of auyais. Set up all the time in my and here's why I bring it up. Because I didn't grow up wearing it, and I wore it in, you know, when I started the podcast. Maybe 3 years ago is when I started to put it on. Maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago is when the first time I put one on. And I feel comfortable, and sometimes I feel uncomfortable. And I realize feeling comfortable is really just a state of mind, but I have to still examine the reasons why I feel uncomfortable. You're the perfect person to kind of have this dialogue with, is because I feel like, am I appropriating something that doesn't belong to me? Of course it belongs to me. My mother was an aoyai maker, right? My mother was making aoyais way before I was born. I am that by birth. It should be allowed to wear it wherever. However, in the context of what I do in the world today, I am an American. I was born in America, but I am using this garment to perhaps appropriate it for my own sort of cultural benefits. That's the feeling I get.
I think you have been a part of a very effective colonial brainwashing. That's the best way I can put it. Now, I say this because my students, and I teach a course, it's Fashionology, so social political impact of fashion. We talk about Alzai and everything else in there. And I often will have students that say, I can't wear the, say, kippah or hanbok, whatever their national dress is, because it makes me, as you say, feel uncomfortable for a variety of reasons, or it makes them look weird or whatever. But maybe they don't mind a Madonna or a Selena or whomever wearing it, because, or Janet Jackson or whomever, you know, that is quote unquote appropriating these things, because that's where visually they see it. And people are confident about it, and they just wear it, no holds barred or whatever. And they themselves are so uncomfortable around even thinking about that. And I think, so for me, Alzai is so, like so much of my work, it is so much more than an Alzai. Alzai is just simply, you could just call it national dress on this side of it, right? But it could represent identity. It could represent country. It could represent culture. It could represent so much. So when you are looking at, say, Aozai, when you're looking at Aozai, it is not just an Aozai. So I think your focus on, what this garment is, but you're actually struggling with issues of being Vietnamese.
Okay. Okay, I got to jump in. I definitely agree it's an issue of being Vietnamese. However, it's not what you think it is. I have two issues with the Aozai right now when I wear it. The first issue is I don't think about what Americans, white America or America is thinking of me. I think about all the young kids in Vietnam looking at, you know, these older 40, 50-year-old people just wearing an Aozai to a movie premiere going, look at this clown wearing... No. And I'm just being vulnerable and honest and open right now. That's the first one. The first one is not the American view, because I feel very proud when I get to wear it out in America. So I'm thinking about what Vietnam, the motherland, is thinking about. Young people in the motherland. Second thing I'm thinking about is a gender issue. Gender-wise, I am a straight Vietnamese man. And I...
Wow.
Right? This is what's going on in my mind. Because my mother, she would always tell me, only the gays wear aozais.
No.
And this is sort of like perpetuating
the gender. There's a lot going on there. There's a lot to unpack. But I think that is a part of this idea of unpacking us in general, you know? And aozai really serves as a mechanism for that. And that's why I think it's fascinating, you know, how sartorial anything is such a huge part of us. I mean, we wear clothes and we don't just put on, no one puts on anything for just to put on. People say, I'm just putting on something to be comfortable. No, it is actually a conscious effort to even say that. It means something. It all means something in a major way, even if you think it doesn't. And so here, the first part of it is, you know, when there was a high schooler wearing a kipao to the prom. At first, people were like, whatever. But then the Asian Americans were like, oh my God, that's appropriating. They got really upset. But the ones that were loudest were white people. They were like, you know, you shouldn't be doing this because they're trying to be liberal. I don't know. But in any case, but in China and other places, they're like, how cool. Yeah. Here's a person who is interested. And so I will say to you, 100% of the time, especially in Vietnam, young people would have you. They're like, that's cool. That's a cool brother right there, you know, donning his aozai. Good for him. And the part about being gay, I think that is like very much our moment in time, because men wore aozais, you know, historically, in the same time frame as women. And it's only in our context now that men wear it less, because there was a period where, you know, maybe westernization came in and the idea of wearing aozai represented maybe an older way of thinking about this. But all that is all, you know, manufactured and branded and a part of a national identity or not. So, you know, how that, you know, tomorrow, if some government or somebody says, where if you are a male, wearing aozai, that is a true being, truly Vietnamese, then that's going to happen. Then that's going to be the fact. So right now, just because, you know, your mother and others of that generation are saying, oh, only LGBTQ or a gay men are wearing this because that's what they're perceiving or that's what they're seeing or that's what they're narrating, that just, you know, sets up a standard that you can follow or not follow, right? But it's not the reality of things, and it will change next year or the following year or 10 years from now. It doesn't matter. But moreover, what I do, and I would encourage you to do the same, is like have that, you know, fuck it attitude. Like I'm fucking, you know, Kenneth Nguyen, and I'm wearing this fucking aozai, and I'm going to be the, you know, the standard here, and, or I'm going to be leading this way, and other people are going to be like secretly go, oh, that's cool, you know, and then they start wearing it, and that's how it happens. Because if, you know, I mean, I get it. And I think at your age to have this fear, I think it's more of the struggle with everything. It's really beyond the aozai.
Masculinity, for sure. It's
everything.
you know, this idea of masculine identity for a 48-year-old Vietnamese man born in America, it's a lifelong journey to unpack this shit. It's, you know,
wow.
When it comes to,
well, maybe as I could, you know, help you, you know, do this, because once you wear that, and you know, and I think that's what people say about the Aozai, you know, they say once they don it, there's something that comes over them, you know, and it could be different for you. It could be a set of questions and, you know, maybe insecurities that you're, you know, unpacking. For other people, they're like, oh, I feel like I'm Vietnamese. Or maybe for, you know, for the queer community, wearing an Aozai and wearing a feminine Aozai, for them is about being a truly themselves. And maybe they see themselves as a Vietnamese, a feminized version of a Vietnamese person. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's I'll, like, I'll you know,
fun story. This year I had six of them made for myself, because I found a way
good
to
for
make
you.
Them cheap. I found an inexpensive way to make them.
Okay.
And I went to DC back in September. And I'd been wearing Ao Yai all year, you know, many events I go to with my Ao Yai. And I was in DC. I brought three Ao Yais because I had these multiple events that I had to go to. And I brought three. Every event that I went to, people came up to me and my good friends would come up to me. And this one man, he's 60. He's one of my best friends in DC, comes up to me and he's like a super macho guy that we all like, I've known for 20 years. And he says to me, "Yo, Ken, I don't own an Ao Yai, but that shit looks dope on you." And he's like this super like martial arts guy. And he asked me, I offered, "Would you like to have it?" It was a black velvet Ao Yai. "Would you like to have it?"
Nice.
And he said, "Yes, I would love to have it."
Oh, that's beautiful.
So he said he would wear it to all like the, you know, that festival was it. And then so another friend of mine actually asked the same thing, if he can borrow it. And he borrowed it for a gala and ended up giving my, so I brought three, gave two in DC.
Uh-huh.
And it is something that that now I'm going to make more this year in 2024.
Yeah.
I'll make more and wear more. But I just wanted to share my thoughts with you, because, you know, this is something that we share, this whole idea of Ao Yai and what it means for different segments of the Vietnamese population.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will have different ideas. And that's why I'm so... that's why, I mean, for me, it really was in many ways my gateway back to being what I think of being a Vietnamese person. You know, my I wore a few during Bangye, during high school culture show, college culture show. And then when I started coming back to Vietnam as in my early 20s, I bought some fabric in Thailand, went to my grandmother's tailor. See, she's like, "Go to this tailor. She's still there." And I went to the tailor and I got it made. And the tailor was telling me I had to dress it this way and that way, which is so Vietnamese, you know, to tell you how you need to have your Aozai. And then wearing that Aozai and seeing how Aozai had a resurgence back in Vietnam and just being really, you know, proud of the ways in which the Aozai has transformed, you know, led me to, you know, my work curating on the Aozai, and I'm working on an exhibit curating the Aozai. And I know one of you had a guest, Mr. Si Huang, who I've known for 30 years, and we're working on a project with Aozai. And so I would say that, you know, I think when I try to think of one item that to me can speak about Vietnamese culture through, you know, like looking at Vietnam through the lens of Aozai, but seeing how, you know, photographers look at Aozai, musicians look at Aozai, you know, filmmakers look at Aozai, so on and so forth, business people look at Aozai, and so on. You know, it's like, there's that really, you know, clear, easy connection that one can make about one's relationship to Vietnam and being Vietnamese and being proud of this one item that is uniquely Vietnamese, even though it has origins from all over the place, but that's part of us, you know, having connections and origins and changes through different regimes, and certain regimes, you know, we weren't even allowed to make Aozai until, you know, recently, and then we'll make Aozai again. And then the Vietnamese here and their Aozai is like pre-75 designs, you know, up to like, say, 20 years ago, it was maybe even 15 years ago, you had predominantly pre-1975 designs, which was all in Saigon silk and the mini, you know, with the white palazzo pants. And that's all they knew for years until they started buying outside from Vietnam. Then it's like, oh, we can actually have different designs. We can send stuff back to Vietnam. We can, it's like this, you can tell the history of our people through the flows of Aozai, and our reconnection with our culture or Vietnam or being Vietnamese or being Vietnamese American. So yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised that you can have this relationship with the Aozai and pass it on, if you will, quite literally, to people who, yeah, maybe you had assumptions about, and deep down they just wanted connections to the outside, and you modeled for them, and they're like, oh yeah, I want to look like Kenneth,
You have, I think, an event next year with the Aozai with Anh Si Hoàng, which it came on who came on to the show. And I would like to revisit your conversation with Aoyai next year, perhaps
Love to.
reconnect, and we can really just devote a whole episode with you talking about the event for the
Oh
Aoyai.
yeah.
And
Yes, it's the Aozai Festival in San Jose, where the city has a day of it's called Aozai Day, May 15th. And so yes, May 15th. So we have annual event that's gone global, if you will, and we have international participants. So I'd love to talk more
yeah,
about that because
let's get into a whole
huge.
episode of just the Aoyai and the
Yeah.
history and that perspective. I did talk
Absolutely.
with the Si Hoàng in Vietnamese, but we should get an English episode sometime around the beginning of May.
That sounds, yeah, maybe even earlier.
Earlier.
Because May is when we're having our big event.
Okay.
So I'm hoping you'll squeeze me in earlier and then
Yeah.
we'll talk
Sounds
more
good.
about that.
Maybe April. Kulin, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I thoroughly enjoyed myself and
That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed getting to know you and the work you're doing here. So I'm very honored that you asked me to come and speak on some issues.
And likewise, I feel the same way.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.